You are listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast, focusing on the changing nature of retirement today and the non-financial aspects of a successful retirement transition. Join host Joe Casey and learn from leading experts in the field and the stories of people who created interesting second acts as they share practical ideas and tips to create your own. Check out our website at retirementwisdom.com, where you can download our newsletter and other resources to learn more about how coaching can help you. The best way to support this podcast is to head over to Apple Podcasts and post a rating and a comment. It's easy and it's free. Join our conversations and get wiser about your retirement.
Welcome to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. There's an old saying that takes two to tango, and that's true with retirement planning. You need to focus on two halves of the equation. You have to be prepared for the non-financial aspects, how you're going to invest your time. But let's face it, you also have to get the money right. And today's conversation is with a true expert that can help all of us get smarter about the financial planning required for a great retirement. My guest today is Wade Fow. Wade is the author of numerous books on retirement planning, and his new book is The Retirement Planning Guidebook, Navigating the Important Decisions for Retirement Success. Wade Fow is the founder of Retirement Researcher, the professor of retirement income at the American College of Financial Services, a higher education institution for financial planners, and he's also the director of retirement research for McLean Asset Management and InStream. He earned a PhD in economics from Princeton University in 2003 with a dissertation about Social Security reform and became a CFA charterholder in 2011. So, Wade, thanks so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
So, Wade, our listeners have just heard your bio. And I'm wondering, what's the backstory of how you first became interested in the study of retirement and retirement planning?
It started in part just personal interest in financial and retirement planning, to kind of saving for retirement and that sort of thing. And when I was in grad school, I did my dissertation about in the early 2000s, President Bush, the second Bush, had the proposal to personalize Social Security and carve out like personal retirement accounts. And so I analyzed that as a reform proposal. And that really became the basis of everything I've done since. It's really about simulating how different strategies work with different types of market outcomes and so forth. I took a sidestep from there. I moved to Japan and I was an economics professor for 10 years, focusing more on pension funds in emerging market countries. But as a part of wanting to come back to the US again, I really kind of stumbled into financial planning as a distinct field and never looked back at that point.
So what are the key risks to manage in planning for retirement?
They really get into a few different categories. Longevity risk is worth mentioning first. And it's a good thing in a way. It's the idea you don't know how long you're going to live, and you might live a very long time, which is wonderful. But just on the financial side, it's expensive to live a long time. You have to fund your retirement for more and more years. So longevity risk really is the overarching risk. Then you've got the different types of market risk and market volatility, interest rates that are changing and so forth, just market-related risks. And inflation could be part of that as well, but even a low inflation rate over a long retirement can really compound over time. And then everything else really falls into a category of spending shock, which is you may have a reasonable baseline budget that you anticipate, but just the unexpected events that happen outside of that. Or, I mean, you may have a sense something that may or may not happen, like a big healthcare bill, having to pay for long-term care, having to care for other family members in an unexpected way, anything that just relates to having to pay more than you anticipated as an additional spending shock. So it's longevity, market risk, and spending shock. Those are the three primary categories.
There's a lot that can happen, and it's hard to predict everything. So in your new book, The Retirement Planning Guidebook, you point out that the traditional concept of retirement is increasingly unaffordable. How should people begin to think about funding the long retirements of today?
Mm-hmm. And in that context of being unaffordable, the nuance was more just, it's becoming more expensive. And it's this combination of, as people live longer, that's a longer time horizon they need to be able to support. And then now, as interest rates have gotten so low, that's really the basis of how much income can a portfolio generate. And in a low interest rate environment, it becomes, you need a lot more assets to meet the same level of sustainable spending throughout retirement. So that's really what I was trying to get at there, is retirement today is becoming more expensive than it was in the past. And then that's the great question of like, how do you then build a strategy around that? Whether you're going to take your chances with the stock market, whether to pool that market risk, whether to hold individual bonds as a part of the strategy, and just other types of resources as well, like making sure to claim Social Security in a smart way, just the potential for part-time work in retirement and not necessarily fully phasing out of the labor force and so forth. There's a lot of different options because retirement certainly is feasible. It's just more expensive than it was in the past. And you really need to keep an open mind about those possibilities.
So you need to be concerned about generating income.
Absolutely. Uh-huh. And that it's more expensive to do that when interest rates are low.
So what's your view of the 4% rule today?
Well, the 4% rule really is a simplification that's meant to only give us some sort of guideline about what is a sustainable level of spending. It assumes that people are invested for 30 years or 30-year long retirement. They're holding 50 to 75% stock. They don't have to pay any investment fees. They don't have to pay taxes out of the 4%, or if it's like from an IRA, they're paying taxes out of the 4%, but it doesn't apply to a taxable account. It assumes a simple asset allocation strategy of just large cap U.S. stocks and intermediate term government bonds. And then it's assuming you're always going to want to take the same inflation adjusted spending amount out of your portfolio every year. So there's a lot of assumptions there that may not make a lot of sense for people. Also, if you have a lot of other income sources outside of your portfolio, it's not necessarily catastrophic if your investments are depleted. So you might be able to take more risk. The 4% rule is trying to build in this assumption that you don't want to deplete your investment assets within a 30-year time horizon. But if you do keep all those standard assumptions that go into the 4% rule and just move it away from saying, well, that's what worked in historical data, and account for the fact that interest rates are now lower than they ever were in the historical data, I think 3% is a much more reasonable starting point than 4%. In a low interest rate world.
You mentioned in your book that there are different types of retirement income styles. How can people learn more about that and how can they assess the style that's right for them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's based on newer research that I did with Alex Murguia, and it leads off the book. The kind of the first 15 pages are about, there's four basic retirement income styles we talk about. The total return investing, which is kind of like the 4% rule. It's use an aggressive asset allocation and have some sort of rule about how you're going to spend from the portfolio. Time segmentation, which is the idea of using bonds for short-term expenses, stocks for long-term expenses. Income protection, which is about using simple income annuities to build a baseline floor and then investing for like more discretionary types of expenses on top of that. And then risk wrap, which is the new type of annuities, deferred annuities that don't require you to hand over the lump sum assets, you keep that liquidity, but you have an optional benefit added to support a guaranteed lifetime income. And so the first step of really starting to think about retirement is to understand what sort of style resonates with you as an individual. And are you comfortable with all the assumptions that go into the 4% rule, which assumes you're comfortable relying on the stock market to fund your retirement? Or are you someone who prefers to have more contractual protection supporting what you're going to spend, whether that's through holding individual bonds or through annuities, and then how much optionality do you want to maintain versus how willing are you to commit to a strategy that helps guide us to understand better, like which of those four strategies is going to resonate best with an individual. So that as a starting point for the discussion, you know that the 4% rule is not right with you if you're not comfortable relying on the stock market, because if with a low stock allocation, 4% can't work when interest rates are this low. So you can think about, is that the way you want to go, or do you want to look at one of the other different strategies as well?
So for various reasons, some people have an allergic reaction to annuities. And I'm wondering, what should people know about annuities today and their role in retirement income planning?
Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about annuities, and a lot of the financial service profession has really kind of indicated that just relying on the stock market is fine as a way to fund retirement. And it's just, I think there's a misunderstanding that risk, well, we already talked about retirement risk. Those were different than the pre-retirement risk. Like pre-retirement, you're mostly relying on your income from work to fund your lifestyle. And then hopefully you're saving something for the future. Post-retirement, you don't have that luxury anymore. You're more exposed to what's happening when you're taking distributions from your portfolio. It's the idea of sequence of returns risk, that if I'm selling from a portfolio when it's losing value, I can dig a hole that becomes really hard to recover from. And so in that regard, it's not that an investments-only type strategy won't work. I mean, it could still work fine. And historically, the U.S. stock market has, whenever there's been a downturn, it's recovered pretty quickly. So people have been okay. But there's risk associated with that. And the annuity, it's not really giving up anything. It's a different way to fund retirement. Instead of relying on the stock market for outsized gains, you look into the issue of risk pooling, which is the insurance company. Like, as an individual, I don't know how long I'll live. I might make it to 66. I might make it to 96. So if I'm trying to self-manage that risk, I have to act as though I'll live to 96 and spend a lot less to make sure I don't run out of money before then. But the insurance company is able to pool that risk, and they don't know any one individual how long they'll live, but their actuaries know that, well, on average, people live to 86. Some won't live as long, some will live longer. And by doing that, I can now spend, like, I'll live to 86. If I do end up not living as long, I may give up something to the risk pool, but I do that in exchange for, if I live to 96, I have these mortality credits coming through the annuity to support that additional spending. That idea of risk pooling, it's actually quite competitive with the stock market. So it really should be on an equal basis of, as I think about funding my retirement, am I comfortable with the stock market and the risk premium from the stock market? Or would I be more comfortable with the contractual protection offered through risk pooling to help fund a longer retirement? And then that's the starting point. And I think they deserve an equal billing. Like, either strategy is fine and viable. And it's just a matter of understanding what's best for any one individual.
So a similar topic is reverse mortgages. What's your take on reverse mortgages today?
Yeah, I tend to get a lot of tomatoes thrown at me just because I talk about annuities, reverse mortgages, things that sometimes have a negative public perception. But it's the same issue again. It's retirement risk is different. And people are more vulnerable to market volatility. And so relying on an investment portfolio alone can create risks that people aren't used to dealing with. And that's where, in looking at reverse mortgages, there can be a high initial setup cost to start a home equity conversion mortgage, which is the most reverse mortgages are administered through the government-administered program, the home equity conversion mortgage. But it can create a lot of flexibility for a retirement plan, where now you have essentially liquidity for your home equity, that the value of your home you can now incorporate into your retirement plan, and you can work with it strategically. So that maybe if there's a market downturn, instead of selling from my portfolio at a loss, I temporarily source the spending from the reverse mortgage. And then that gives my portfolio a chance to recover, I mean, hopefully, before I have to resume spending from the portfolio again. Or I could refinance a traditional mortgage going into retirement so I don't have that fixed mortgage payment in my early years when I'm more vulnerable to a market downturn. I push that off until later in retirement. I mean, there's many different ways a reverse mortgage can be incorporated into a retirement plan, but I really came on board with the idea of looking at it as another viable tool just because it can add so much flexibility and help to manage these new retirement risks. Again, people aren't used to these risks, but they exist, and these types of tools can help manage those risks in a very effective way.
So another transition that people have to deal with is moving from the accumulation phase to the spending phase. And you have a good analogy in your book or metaphor about climbing a mountain, the mountain climber. What are your thoughts on managing that transition from accumulating to spending?
And that's the big question for everyone as they get closer to retirement, because one of the factors in that retirement income style awareness is just, do you acknowledge this transition as being relevant? If you're someone who has more of an accumulation focus, you continue to just focus on the pre-retirement style investing, the risk-adjusted returns, like how can I maximize my portfolio balance? Other people will have what we call distribution focus, which is the maximizing the returns from your portfolio is no longer the primary objective. You'd rather focus on having predictable income, and you might be willing to sacrifice some return to have a more predictable, less fluctuating income in retirement. And if you are someone who does have that distribution focus, that's where the transition from pre-retirement to post-retirement becomes important. And that's where you're going to start to change your investing strategy. If your total returns, you might just lower your stock allocation as you get closer to retirement, just like target date funds and 401k plans and that sort of thing do. If your time segmentation, then the transition to retirement is more, instead of holding bond funds, like a constant maturity type bond fund that has interest rate risk and so forth, you start transitioning that into a bond ladder where maybe 10 years from retirement, I start buying a 10-year bond every year so that when I get to retirement, now for the next 10 years, I have bonds maturing to support my income over those next 10 years as an example. And if you're in the like an income protection or risk wrap style, the transition to retirement is more the same idea, I think, to the extent that you're comfortable using bonds to purchase annuities that will have a deferred start date for income so that you start building towards your fixed income assets are going to support income for you starting at your planned retirement date. And that would be the with the different styles how you could start to think about the transition to retirement.
You'll know from listening to this podcast that, like many of you, a card-carrying, lifelong learner. And that's why I'm thrilled today to bring this offer from One Day University to our listeners. You know, every college has that one professor whose class was so popular that students lined up to get a spot before they graduate. Well, One Day University brings over 200 of these top-rated professors together online to present incredible live stream talks based on their most popular courses. And the professors are selected from schools across the country, including Yale, Stanford, Harvard, UCLA, Duke, Michigan, Columbia, and many more. Every weekday, One Day University offers a new one-hour live stream talk, followed by a live Q&A with the professor. So you can learn something new every day about history, politics, art, science, music, psychology, and much more. And best of all, there's no homework or tests, just the joy of learning new things from incredible professors. Memberships are just $8.95 a month, or $89 a year, but you can try 2 weeks for free. Plus, if you visit onedayu.com/wisdom and sign up for an annual plan, you can get your first year for half price. Here are some talks that I found interesting. First, The Art of Aging by Katherine Sanderson at Amherst College. Next, Books That Changed the World by Joseph Luzzi at Bard College. And then Four Films That Changed America by Mark Lapidula at Yale. I'll include a link in the show notes to the video library so you can browse it for yourself and see what jumps out to you. So learn more and start your 2-week free trial at onedayu.com/wisdom. That's www.onedayu.com/wisdom. And you'll find that link in the show notes. Well, I'm sure this will vary from person to person, like most of the questions I'm going to ask you. What do you see as the pros and cons of working longer?
So there's a lot of pros on the financial side as well as the non-financial side. I mean, on the financial side, working longer is the easiest way to help get a retirement plan back on track because you now have a longer career, more time for your wealth to grow and compound, a shorter subsequent retirement, a more opportunity to delay Social Security benefits and other potential pension incomes and that sort of thing. So delaying retirement can have a huge positive impact on the finances in retirement. On the non-financial side as well, employment doesn't just, I mean, it provides income, but it also provides a lot more related to like purpose and passion. And for people who they may enjoy their work or they may really need to have the structure of work or the camaraderie or social engagement of work or the feeling of importance they get through work. So all those sort of non-financial aspects can be addressed as well. The cons, it depends on everyone's situation. And like if somebody's in more, if they just hate their job or if they are, it's a more physically demanding job and they just like with their health are not able to sustain that, it can create a lot of stress. People may have to leave the labor force sooner than anticipated, which not necessarily a con of working longer, but a con of assuming you could work longer if either due to health concerns or involuntary job loss or having to become a caregiver for a spouse or a parent or someone else. those are all situations where you might have thought you were going to work longer than ultimately you were able to do. And I'd say those are the cons. Probably in a lot of cases, the pros will outweigh the cons for a lot of people. Everyone has to decide on their personal situation there.
And you mentioned something, and clearly it was in your book, and some stat I always mention because I think it surprises people, that this happens frequently, having to retire earlier than planned, about half. Talk a little bit about why having a plan B is a wise move.
Mm-hmm. And there's studies that come out time every so often about that issue, and it looks like a reasonable estimate is about 40% of people end up retiring sooner than they anticipated. And the plan B there is, it stresses the finances. It's like if I was planning to retire at 65 and I end up having to retire at 62, I'm now going to have a shortfall with my retirement savings. So the plan B is either try to accelerate your estate. Well, it's not a plan B, but try to save in anticipation of retiring sooner so that you're prepared. Or I guess the plan B in that scenario would be have in mind how you might be able to adjust your expenses and lifestyle to adapt to the situation where you might have to retire sooner than anticipated and therefore have to adjust a reasonable, sustainable spending level for your retirement. And having some flexibility with the spending would be the main trigger for dealing with that situation.
So another big decision people consider in retirement is where to live. What should people keep in mind in thinking about whether to move or age in place?
So a lot of people may think about moving. The data does show that people move less in retirement, that the moving rates are lowest for people in like their 50s, 60s, and 70s. There's an uptick as people have to move to institutional care, like late in life for healthcare reasons and so forth. But they don't often move. And so with aging in place, you want to start thinking ahead about, are you living in a location that will support aging in place? Now, you can do some basic home renovations, so like having a bathing facility and a bedroom on the first floor, having wide enough hallways so that it's like easy to have wheelchair accessibility and so forth. There's a whole world of aging in place home renovations that can be done. But beyond that, in terms of thinking ahead, are you living in somewhere that's affordable? Does it have good transportation options if you're limited in your ability to drive? Are there good healthcare and long-term facilities nearby? Does it have an agreeable climate for you? Are you close to family and friends, which is, and especially family, if like your children and grandchildren are living elsewhere in the country? Are you okay with settling where you are? Do you want to live closer to them? Those would be the types of things to be thinking about as you approach that decision.
As an introvert, I appreciated a comment in your book that goes like this. It seems like most of the books about the non-financial side are written about extroverts. And I was just wondering, what are a few of the non-financial challenges you see introverts and also extroverts, because we have them as listeners as well, face in transitioning to retirement?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's important because I've historically always focused more on the financial side. So to build out the chapter on the non-financial aspects of retirement, I was doing a lot of reading. And it always just seemed like, oh, in retirement, you have all this extra time. So you go join the local like social clubs and everything, make all kinds of new friends, move into like age 55 plus or age 62 plus communities, join all the social groups, go to the dining facilities and meet everyone and just have a wonderful time. And I just couldn't help but thinking that a lot of people will struggle with all that. And that becomes a part of the idea of moving in retirement. Moving is a stressful event. Retiring is a stressful event. So for people who are thinking they do want to retire and immediately move, you might want to separate that out a little bit to just not have too much happening all at once. And this also becomes an important conversation for couples or partners to consider as well. If one person is more outgoing than the other, maybe one of them is an extrovert, the other is an introvert, they may have a very different idea about how they want to spend their time in retirement and whether they do want to join all these social clubs or all these new opportunities they can have to have this social engagement with their additional time now that they're not working. Well, does that fit their personality? Is it something they're going to want to do and be able to do and enjoy? I think partners in particular need to discuss this in advance to make sure that there's a plan for things you'll do together, things you'll do separately, and make sure people are happy with all those decisions.
And I love that you included the Venn diagram from Don Ezra, who we've had on our podcast with his book, Life 2, a great one and great visual on how to think about that, the things you love to do individually and things you love to do together. Great thing to have. I think in my retirement, whenever that comes, which will be very late, I think, I'd like to work. I love what I do. I will probably sign up for the social aspects of a book club, and that'll be it.
That'll be enough.
But we'll see. So I'm curious about what are some of the things that you see mistakes people make, common errors that they should seek to avoid in planning for retirement?
I mean, there's a lot there to be aware of. I think just in the past, this issue of retirement income styles is kind of important because people just sort of got fed into a strategy that may not have really been right for them. Either it's too high of stock allocation or they were sold an annuity that they really didn't need or want. So that's one area. Medicare is another area where there's a lot of financial costly mistakes. People do need to understand that there's only a very rare exception where Medicare does not become the primary payer once you achieve eligibility. And so a lot of health insurance that you may think you can use by law is no longer the primary payer, and you may not have a primary payer if you don't switch to Medicare at age 65. Social Security is another one. I know a lot of people like to claim closer to age 62, when at least for the high earner and the couple, it's important to think about the value of waiting till closer to 70 to delay, not thinking ahead about the non-financial aspects of retirement. As we were talking about, it's important to have something to retire to instead of something you're retiring from. Don't retire because you hate your job. Retire because there's something you'd rather be doing instead, or else you're otherwise going to get into the inertia of sitting around the house, maybe watching too much television, that sort of thing. It's very important to avoid. Those are probably a good list of basic mistakes people might make.
Appreciate that. And I really enjoyed and benefited from reading your book, but I also follow your work on Retirement Researcher and really appreciate the depth you go into and the type of topics you cover. Tell us a story about Retirement Researcher and how you created that and a little bit more about that. We'll include a link to it in the show notes.
Sure. It started as a blog all the way back. I think my first post was in September 2010. That was when I was still living in Japan, and it was part of my efforts to become marketable to find a job in the U.S. But it really took off from there. And then eventually working with Alex McGee and McLean Asset Management, it became part of the sister firm. And it's more for the a combination of do-it-yourself type individuals as well as financial advisors. So talking about in depth on different retirement topics. We now have the Retirement Researcher Academy, which is a paid membership site more for do-it-yourself retirees who don't really feel personal finance may be a hobby. So they don't necessarily feel like they need a financial advisor, but they'd still like a group to shoot ideas off of and so forth. And so, I mean, the Retirement Researcher website's really just kind of evolved in that direction of being a resource for do-it-yourself individuals and financial advisors.
And Wade, one last question, if I could. How can people assess their preparedness for retirement?
That's an important question. And as a part of writing the book, I really became much more bullish on the concept of a funded ratio, which it's been around for a long time. But as I was looking more and more at it, I realized that I like it much better than right now. Mostly what you'd hear is the answer is put your inputs about your budget and your financial goals and your assets into the software that will run a Monte Carlo simulation and report a probability of success. And the funded ratio idea just looks at it from a different angle. It's instead of getting a probability of success, you just assume a reasonable investment return. And if you link it to kind of bond yields, you can see, will your plan work without taking any market risk? And so you look at, well, all my assets are going to earn some sort of bond interest rate, do I have enough assets to fund all my retirement expenses? And this gives you the flexibility, too, to not just have your budget, your legacy goal, but also you can build in specific contingencies. Like you can build in, what if I have to spend 4 years in a nursing home? So let's put in an expense for that and just see if we have enough assets to meet this all these different potential expenses that we'll face in retirement. And if you're 100% funded, that's a great sign that you have sufficient assets that you're prepared for retirement. And if you're still pre-retirement, you can include your future salary as an asset, the human capital, the value of your future earnings as an asset And then assuming you actually do the work you've outlined there, that can be part of this saying, okay, based on my current trajectory, my planned retirement date, my projected future earnings, do I have enough assets to meet my liabilities? And I think that's a great way as just a starting point to assess, am I on track to, am I prepared for retirement?
And that's the goal. So Wade, thank you so much for taking time to share your wisdom with all of us. And congratulations on your latest book. Great resource.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks to Wade Fow for giving us a very comprehensive primer on some of the big decisions and complexities that really are key in planning for a great retirement. And his guidebook is very comprehensive. It also includes a very good chapter on the non-financial aspects of retirement. And I'd highly recommend his website, Retirement Researcher. They have webinars. He has a great blog and series of articles. And the weekly newsletter that really captures in depth a lot of the key topics that you'll want to know more about. You'll find links to his book and the Retirement Research website in the show notes, along with Wade's full bio. But don't forget, it does take two halves of this equation to get a great retirement. And what happens when you do anything halfway? Financial planning for retirement is critical, but are you doing all of this hard work to just end up with a mediocre retirement? I don't think so. So while you're doing all the financial planning work with an advisor or by yourself, also start planning for how you'll invest your most valuable asset, your time. I help people do that through the Design Your Life process, developed by Bill Burnett and Dave Evans at Stanford. It's a three-phase program based on the principles of design thinking. It helps you envision and reality test alternative versions of your future. You can explore some new possibilities based on the things that matter most to you. Take a look at our website, retirementwisdom.com. You can learn more there. Take charge of your future. You can schedule a call with me to discuss how this may be helpful to you and help you balance your retirement planning. Do your retirement planning homework, but don't do it halfway. Thank you for listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. You can find all 112 episodes across four seasons on one page at our website, retirementwisdom.com. Our mission is to help you live a great retirement by balancing your approach.
Thank you for joining us today on the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. You can listen to all episodes of our podcast by subscribing to them on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher, or on our website at retirementwisdom.com.